to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, 89.1 FM, where we explore the people, stories, and events in our seven-county listening area in central Iowa. We are happy you are joining us for our Christmas Eve special edition of Storytelling. My co-host Paul Wearson is one of the storytellers, and he knows our guests from the Story Festival held each year in Story City. So I'll turn the introductions over to you, Paul.
Well, thank you very much, Susan. I'm really enjoying this segment already because I know it's going to be fun. We have people I know who know storytelling, and I do a little storytelling myself. And at Christmas, I always think of Ebenezer Scrooge and A Christmas Carol and that great tale that symbolizes Christmas, and so I'm eager for this show. I want to introduce Maureen Corte and Dan Bagley. They've both been up for the storytelling festival we have in Story City the last weekend, or the third to the last weekend of September, each and every year, and we're going to have our 10th anniversary next September. And so, welcome to Maureen and to Dan. And Maureen, you might tell us how you got involved in storytelling. Everyone has their story about how they began to be a storyteller.
Indeed, we all do. When I was 6 years old, a neighbor actually came to my mother and said that she felt that the little dramas, the puppet shows, and the stories that I was telling around the neighborhood were perhaps getting a little out of hand, and my mother should get a handle on it. And my mother, in her great Irish wisdom, said, "Oh, glory be to God, now it's not a problem at all. It's a gift. She just needs a little direction." And with that, she enrolled me in theater classes. And I came out the very first Saturday and got in the back seat of the car, and my father said, "Well, now, what did you think of the theater, Maureen?" And I said, "Da, I love it so much, I think I'll do it for the rest of my life." Well, when I went to college, I didn't major in theater, although I had been in theater all my life in plays and backstage. I instead chose to major in English. And when I got married and we had children, my husband was building a business and out of town a lot. So I couldn't be in productions and hire a babysitter for 6 weeks at a time while I went to practice. And one of the things that kept my two very busy boys quiet was a story. So I began merging my theater and my love of literature, and I began acting out the stories. And their friends would come over, and they'd say, "Mom, act out a story for us." And I'd do that, and then all of a sudden people were knocking on the door saying, "I don't know what it is you do, but my son loves it, and I'll give you $25 if you'll come do it for the birthday party." So I started telling stories professionally and traveling all over the world about 25 years ago.
Well, that's a great story. And actually, Maureen is very Irish. She looks like she should be co-starring with John Wayne in The Quiet Man. And here's Dan Bagley. He is a jolly old elf, and he's going to tell us how he got involved with storytelling.
Well, actually, it started when I was a young lad going to Boy Scout camp. And I'd hear these stories being told, and I thought, "Well, gee, I can do that." And so I started, and it was always great. And then pretty soon I was invited to tell stories at other camps. And it was just a great deal of fun. And then I grew up, and my daughter-in-law gave me a thing that said, "You got to go to the Story City Festival." And I went, and I fell in love with storytelling. And I met Tim Tingle, who has become a mentor, very fine storyteller. He's a Choctaw Indian. I met Maureen Corte down in Des Moines and joined the club down there. And since that time, I've evolved into telling stories, hearing stories, and traveling all around the country and just enjoying stories immensely.
I can tell by your face that you're telling the truth this time, too.
Indeed.
Well, you know, storytelling is its own genre, and it is hard to explain to people who were, untutored in this art. But we've found at the festival that people who come in and sample this and discover what it is, it's not all performance, and it's not, you know, it's something in between that. There's some veritas there or something that's different than a performance. We found out that when a storyteller is up front, they want to have the house lights up and interact with the audience, not a darkened theater. That's one big difference. There's no fourth wall.
Correct.
And it's a real intimate experience. And now, this is Christmas, and so Maureen has promised to tell a Christmas story.
All right. This is a personal story, and it is a true story from my past when I was a little girl. When I was a little girl, I grew up in a big white house. And the Christmases we had in that big white house always seemed to be as humongous and extraordinary as the house itself. When I was little, my mother worked, and no other mothers in the neighborhood worked. But my mother would trade away holiday after holiday after holiday to make sure that she was there on Christmas, for indeed it was her special and most favorite holiday. When we went to buy the tree, we all knew that we would give Mother all the time she needed to pick out whatever tree she wanted. We would bundle up, get in our car, go to the lot, and Mother would look at every single solitary tree. Now, my mother didn't drive, so my father had to take her shopping and other places, and many times I had heard him say, "Oh, for heaven's sakes, Ree, aren't you done? Can't we go home now?" But never ever when she was looking for a Christmas tree was anything like that uttered. She would peruse every single tree and then select one plus a second smaller one. If my sister Kathy, who is 3 years older than I, and I were good during the selection process, we perhaps got our own very little tree to put in our bedroom, and that was so that we could decorate it, because only the grown-ups and the older children decorated the tree with my mother. We would put both trees on the top of the car, bring them home, and my father would put the big tree in a stand. And then he would assess, and if there was a blank spot or a crooked branch or anything that was not perfect, he would drill a hole in that big tree, cut off a branch from the small tree, and insert it in the large one, so that we had the biggest, the most dynamic, and the most incredible trees in the entire neighborhood. Decorating them was a festive occasion filled with popcorn and hot chocolate, and my sisters and I dancing through the lights, and my mother and father telling us, "Be careful now that you don't cut yourself." Mother would decorate with ornaments that were not bought at places like Kresge's or Walgreens, but indeed they were purchased at places like Joseph's Jewelers and Yonkers. So special were her Christmas ornaments that when she died, she delegated certain ornaments to certain children in her will. We all wanted them. Some of them came from Ireland and others came from all over the world. We always kept our tree up until January 6th, Feast of the Epiphany. And taking it down, indeed, was a very nostalgic occasion. One year I can remember my mother said she just hated to take it down because our bird Noel loved to sit in the tree, and it made her so sad to have him back in his cage. Every year when we would open presents around that tree, I would be many times designated as the Santa Claus. I'd pass out this to my brother Michael and this to my brother Tom and this to my sister Patricia and so on. I would pass out gifts to aunts and uncles and cousins who came to visit for Christmas, and I did pass out gifts to my mother and my father, but I never passed out gifts that said, "From Tom to Ria," or "Ria to Tom," "From Mom to Dad," or "Dad to Mom." I noticed, I believe, in about third grade that my parents never exchanged Christmas gifts. Seeing this, I began to question. I asked my parents repeatedly, "How come you guys don't give each other Christmas gifts? Don't you love each other anymore?" My parents would laugh and say, "Oh, no, 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 indeed. The tree is our gift." "The tree's not a gift," I would reply. "You have to have a tree." As I got older, I began to press them more about it. One year, my friend Karen Thomas's mother got a diamond and my friend Nancy Kern's mom got a mink coat. And I was concerned that my mother was not getting anything from my father. But again, she reassured me that the tree was their gift. When I got into high school and older, I really didn't pay too much attention to what my parents were giving each other, and I was more worried about what my boyfriend was going to give to me. But just as I graduated from university, my father passed away, and I, being the youngest, the only one not married or with children, was asked to come home for a while and take care of my mother until she got on her feet. That meant that I was there before Christmas. And indeed, I put up a Christmas tree for her. And when she saw it, she came in and took it down and said, "I don't want that this year. Your father's not here." "But Mom," I said, you're going to have to celebrate Christmas without him and get used to it. I don't care, she said. I'm not having a tree if your father's not here. She did indeed, though, begin to give all my sisters and brothers and I money for presents for children and $100 for a Christmas tree. We would tell her that we didn't need it, but year after year, she would insist on giving it to us. And always when she did in the envelope with $100, it said, "This is for your tree from your father and I." For many years, my sisters and brothers tried to put up a tree for my mother, but she just wouldn't have it. And so we settled on making sure that she always had a beautiful wreath on the front door. When my sons were about 5 or 6 and 3 or 4, my mother was sitting in the family room one week, oh, a few days before Christmas. She had one of them on her lap and one next to her. And when she finished reading a Christmas story to them, she said, "Don't you think the tree is beautiful, boys?" They said yes, and she said, "You know, the Christmas tree was the greatest gift I could ever get." My oldest son, Patrick, looked at her and said, "But, Grandma, a tree's not a gift. It's something you have to have." "No," she said. "The tree was always a gift to me from your grandfather." "Why would he give you a tree?" Patrick asked. "Well, when I was a little girl, your age, Patrick," my mother explained, "we were very, very poor. My father was a lawyer, but he wasn't as good of a lawyer as he was a drinker, and inevitably he drank up the law practice. One of his relatives gave him a farm thinking he could farm, but he drank a lot better than he farmed. He drank up the twins' identical clothes, and he drank up our Valentines and our Christmas gifts and our shoes every fall. And so we never had a Christmas tree until one year when one of the neighbors knocked on our door and said that he needed to clear some timber off his land. And if we wanted to bring an axe and a sled, we could cut down a Christmas tree for ourselves. My sisters and brothers and I bundled ourselves up and went and cut down the most beautiful tree you could imagine. We dragged it home, and not having a Christmas tree stand, we put it in a bucket with dirt and sand. Having no ornaments, we took old newspapers and envelopes and folded them in fan shapes and all sorts of crinkly things and decorated the tree. We didn't have any candles, and there was no electricity then, but we took the small stubs of some old candles and attached them to the tree. And on Christmas Eve, and only Christmas Eve, we lit the tree for about 5 minutes. We had buckets in front of it so that if anything started on fire, we could grab them and put it out. And we held hands and sang Silent Night. And as we did, I made a promise to myself that when I grew up, no matter what I did or where I lived, I would always have the most beautiful, outstanding Christmas tree in the whole entire world. Your grandfather and I dated for 5 years because it was the Depression and we didn't have enough money to get married. And during that time, your grandfather and I learned each other's stories very well. And knowing my story about Christmas, your grandfather promised me on the day that we got married that every single Christmas for my gift, he would give me the most beautiful Christmas tree in the whole world. And so not to negate the value of that gift, he promised that he too would take it back as his gift. My mother looked at my sons and she said, "And that, my young love, is exactly why the tree is a gift, not something that you have to have. And it is why, ladies and gentlemen, why I learn that my parents and did indeed exchange a wonderful, wonderful Christmas gift every single year of their lives."
Oh, beautiful, Maureen. That's great. And you know, if you could only see Maureen as she told that story, it just had a verite and truth to it that got me in touch with all the Christmas past for me. And that's what storytelling is, often a chunk of your own life that you can share with others, and it's so meaningful. And now we have Dan Bagley here, too, and he's going to share a Christmas story. It's probably unlike the one we just heard. Contrast.
Yes, indeed. at where Santa lives in the North Pole, don't you know? Lots of activities are happening, particularly around this time of year, because those letters come in and the calls about, oh, I'd like a doll, or I'd like this, or I'd like that. Well, the workers work their little fingers off and making toys and getting things ready, and they talk to each other. And they'd go, remember Billy last year? He wasn't quite as good as he could be, but this year he's doing great, and we have a new gift for him, and he will love it. We've checked the list twice to see who was naughty or nice, and by golly, he's a nice young man. And they would be working in the shop, and you could hear the little hammers, tippy-tap, tippy-tap, tippy-tap. And you could almost imagine those little hands working those gifts. And, of course, Santa would come through and say, how's it going, little elves? And they'd say, oh, Santa, this is wonderful. It's so great this year. We're doing so well. The children will just be beside themselves with joy when little Billy opens up that package and sees his gift. He will just shout out, happy holidays. I got it. I got it. Well, Santa was thrilled because it was going so well. And then the next day he comes to the shop. And there's no tippy-tap, tippy-tap, nothing. And he thinks, what's going on? And he gets close, and he can't quite see. And he goes up to the window, and he looks in. He can't see. And he goes, and blows his hot breath on the window and clears the space. And he sees the elves are crying. They're very sad. He walks in and he says, what's happened? And Mrs. Santa Claus says, it's Rudolph. Rudolph? What's wrong? Rudolph's nose, it's not shining bright. He's sick. And Santa goes, oh, this can't be true. And he goes out to the barn and opens the reindeer door. And there's Rudolph laying down. And his nose, oh, his nose is not lit. It's just dark and runny. So what was he to do? He decided to call Iowa State Veterinarian Clinic. And there he talked to the reindeer expert and said, I don't know what to do. Tomorrow's Christmas and all the children. Oh. And the reindeer expert said, well, put him in the barn. And when he's laying down, cover him with a warm blanket and rub his nose with oil tissues so it'll keep his nose really moist. And give him lots of water and check on him. So Santa did those things, and he closed the door, and he went back to the shop, and he said, we're going to have Christmas one way or the other, so keep building those toys, and let's make those boys and girls happy. And Mrs. Claus, she was making cookies and cakes, and pretty soon you could hear it, rap-a-tap, tap, 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 and the toys were being made and wrappings were happening. The next morning, they got ready, and they said, Santa, what do you think? And he said, where do those toys go? In the sleigh, in the red sleigh. Well, let's load it up. And they all came out and they filled up the sleigh. And then they walked to the barn slowly. As they opened the door, a red glow came out. His nose was shining brightly. And Santa said, Rudolph, your nose is shining brightly. You can lead us tonight. We will be able to lead the sleigh. And they hooked up. And they pawed the ground. Rudolph, are you ready? And he nodded and shook his head. And that bright nose lit up the sky. And away they went into the night sky. And boys and girls, tonight, listen for the footsteps of Santa, because the reindeer will come in, and the pitter-patter, pitter-patter, pitter-patter you hear will be the reindeer, led by Rudolph. Away we go.
Oh, wonderful, Dan. Now, right there, you have two examples of stories of Christmas, one from family and the knowledge you have of those who've gone before you and the true experiences of your youth, Maureen. And here we have Dan's story, which is an extension of a known Christmas legend. And so beautifully done. That was, I love your intimate voice and your the way you whispered at the right times and talked softly. And probably the people over at Iowa State appreciate your allusion to their marvelous expertise at solving reindeer problems. And, you know, looking at our own lives, we all have our favorite Christmas story and things that we have done or been known about in our own tradition. And in my tradition at the family Christmas Eve dinner, Mom always made lutefisken lefse. And it's Norwegian cooking is called snowblind cooking. Everything is white. And this is, I can't describe the fish except the smell is horrendous. And you roll it up in what we call a betta with melted butter and mashed potatoes. And then it's kind of like a burrito in the end. But it's something you eat and then go directly to your cardiologist's office. You know, it's enough to clog your veins, but it's a great tradition. And lutefisk, I can't explain. The odor is enough to put you off. But then you think that this is the kind of food eaten by people trapped in a log cabin for 6 months. You know, but it was a festive food. And then Mom, in her great generosity, made roast for us Americans. So I always thought that was a great concession on her part because she was only the second generation in America from the Norwegian culture. And if you get up around Story City or other settlements like Decorah, you'll understand this tradition. And I pity only people who marry into Norwegian families who are a guest at Christmas Eve and walk into this horrendous odor and then find out we're going to eat that. So, you know, like an Italian or some nationality that enjoys spicy foods, this is pretty bland stuff. And I think that, you know, storytelling just puts us in touch with all those things. And everyone in our audience today has their story. As they've listened to you, Maureen and Dan, they are thinking in their own mind, their own story. And they might lack the polish to present that professionally. But everyone can verbalize this. And when you look back in the history of humankind, that's how all communication began, storytelling around the fire, which was later taken down as a written word and a written story. So everything that we have comes from a story. A good example is the Bible. It's a compendium of stories repeated through generations and then written down in the Bible. And that's true of so many of our traditions. And so I think we have time for another story. Maureen, can you favor us?
Yes.
I thought you probably had one or two.
I do, just a few. This one I think is probably my very favorite Christmas story. And it comes to us from England. It is an Arthurian legend. And normally when I tell Arthurian legends, I explain to the audience that all nations in the British Isles claim Arthur as their own. The Irish say that he lived there. The Scots say that he lived in Scotland. Those on the Isle of Man say, no, he lived here. But we know him most from the English and because of their written stories and their portrayals of him in movies. But normally when I tell an Arthurian legend, I tell it the way my sons would like me to tell it, with Arthur having red hair, showing that there was indeed a Norwegian invasion there, and very heavily tattooed because my sons always remind me that the Celtic warriors were the most heavily tattooed warriors in the world, and they did that to psych out their enemies because they were indeed very fierce and powerful. But I read this from the English point of view first, and so I will tell it from that point of view. Long ago, when the world was young, and the stones were as soft as marshmallows, there was far from here a great land that met the sea, known as Ingoland. And in that land there lived a great, a courageous, a kind, and a responsible ruler who had been given the name of Arthur. Now Arthur ruled over the entire island of Ingoland, but indeed knowing that he could not be in every corner of that land, every moment of his life, he drew toward him noble men that he called knights. You I will send out to different kingdoms, he said. You will rule as I do, with graciousness, with courtesy, with courage, but with firmness. And you will come back to me once a year and tell me, report to me what is going on in that kingdom so that we can make decisions to better it or to make sure that it stays the same if it is good. And so it was that Arthur brought his knights in every year deep into the fall and placed them about a table round so that no man seemed more important than the other. And when there, they gave him reports about the crops, the people, the legal system, and everything that went on in the areas in which they governed. And so it became, during that time, a tradition for all the knights to lay down their capes in front of Arthur as they entered the castle and fill those capes with the bounty from the areas that they served. There would be pigs and cows and horses. There would be grasses, wheats. There would be vegetables. There would be materials. And there would be swords and weapons for war. Oh, there would be so many things in those capes. One year, the times were hard in England. A great drought came upon the island, and not a drop of rain fell. And so that year, during what was called the season of giving, the knights all came in a slower fashion. And when they knelt down and put their capes on the ground to be filled, there was less bounty in them. Not as much as there had been in past years. Until the very, very last knight came. He was an old man, and he governed the most distant area of the island for Arthur, an area that was already known to be poor, rain or no. His beard was gray and scraggly, and he had dark circles under his eyes. His cape looked as if it could use a great cleaning, and even his horse seemed to be not up to par with the others. He laid his cape down and knelt into the ground and looked at Arthur and said, "My lord, there is death and devastation in the area where I govern. Women's breasts are empty and infants cry out for milk. And were I to take something from my people to give to you, more of them would die. And so I beg you this year, would you please accept the gift we have to give you, that of love, honor, and loyalty?" Now Arthur indeed was thrilled with this gift, but where there is good, there is also bad. And so it was that on the left side sat Mordred, Arthur's nephew, and he indeed was the darkest soul on earth. He stood and looked at the old knight and said, "How dare you come into here, this area, with nothing to give the king? You do this ever again and you shall be banished forevermore." Arthur did not want to, but to keep peace with his own wife, he let the rule stand. The next year, rain came to some areas of England, but indeed not to the old man's governing. And so when the season of giving came around, again he came in last, more tattered and torn, more gray, and more disheveled. He spread out his cape with holes in it, got down on both knees, and implored Arthur, "Sire, my liege, my lord, please accept our gift of love, honor, and devotion, for it is all we have to give you." Once again, Arthur wanted to accept, but Mordred was on his feet, yelling and screaming at the knight, "Go from here and never come back," he said. And with that, the knight very slowly got on his mount and went out the castle gates. Now, it will never be known if it was the heaviness of the snow or the heaviness in the heart of the knight. But at some time a heaviness came upon the man, so great that it threw him from his mount and onto the ground. He fell upon that old bush, the holly bush, that turned brown in the winter with sharp edges and black berries, and the sharpness of those leaves pierced the man's heart, making blood flow over it and the white snow around it. the next morning when all the knights came by him to leave and go back to their homes, they shook their heads at his death. And then they gathered and dug a grave next to the holly bush, gave their allegiance to him, and went on. The next year, one by one, they came back to the grave on their way to the castle to pay honor to their fallen comrade. But when they did, they noticed that this year the holly bush remained green and the berries red. Every year, for years after, it was so. And so the legend rose that indeed the holly bush stays evergreen and its berries ever red to show people that the greatest gift one can give to another is that of love, honor, and devotion.
Oh, yes, my lady. Camelot is unique, and we have by far and away the most equitable climate in all England. And now a station break by Susan France.
This is KHOI Community Radio, and we have with us today storytellers Maureen Corti, Dan Bagley, and Paul Wearson.
Yeah, I qualify somewhat as a storyteller.
And in a little while, I've been inspired that I will dare to tell a story. But I think that now maybe we would get to a question we were talking about before the program started. How can professional storytellers inspire the natural storytellers, the uncle who tells the stories at Christmas dinner? And in my case, I was a child who told ghost stories at all the slumber parties. I'd absolutely forgotten that I was very much in demand to tell those ghost stories.
We have to say that we're counting on Susan to be wonderful. She is the finale here.
Yes, I know the story I'm going to tell at the end.
Well, I'll tell you what, my Christmas tradition at Story City was to be the little boy who went to the theater. We have this great theater that's been open since 1913, still showing movies today. And they would show that old black and white Scrooge film, you know. Mm-hmm. About Ebenezer and Jacob Marley. And I tell you what, that was a trauma for me. I should be in therapy. Because as soon as that candle blew out, I knew that Marley was coming. So I would duck behind the seat, not wanting to see that apparition, you know. And I just grew up loving the Scrooge story and loving that transition. And, of course, there have been so many wonderful different versions of that on mm-hmm. film. But I still prefer the old black and white with Alastair, whatever his mm-hmm. name is, played the Scrooge, and the marvelous transition he was able to do when he got up in the morning. But one tradition that my grandfather, who came to the United States when he was a young boy, he told the story of the hula tassa. It's not particularly a Christmas story, and I don't have all the detail, but the gist of it was that the hula tassa was a monster that lived in the mountains of Norway, just ready to eat milkmaids who vanished from the farm. It was a cautionary tale to the milkmaids to be dutiful and stay on the farm and work, because if you escaped the farm and went into the hills, you would be consumed by the hula tassa. Mm-hmm. So, you know, once again, traumatic story of my grandfather. I remember looking up into his mustache and nostrils and hearing about the hula tassa, and I really should be a lot sicker than I really am. It's another terrifying story.
You know, Paul, that story and the Christmas story are great examples of why stories were told in ancient times and today. They were told to preserve history. The storyteller was the librarian, the primary source, and it was their job to watch everything and to tell that event back in a fair and accurate fashion so that we would understand and perceive history the way we do today. And stories were also told to pass on morals or lessons, values. And so they set us up for natural and logical consequences in there. You stray away, you're going to get eaten by the hula sasa. And then they were told to entertain. And so people don't have to be professional storytellers to tell stories. And they don't have to tell stories about, you know, running into a burning building and saving someone. They just need to describe a situation by using their six senses, their sight, the smell, the sound, the taste, the touch, and then the emotional feeling that you get from that. And they will be great storytellers.
Well, Dan, tell us about when you went to the Storytelling Festival. Tell us about the osmosis that happened in you to make you feel like you can tell stories and wanted to.
It's funny you should ask that because I've often wondered the same thing. I remember sitting calmly and then this fellow, Tim Tingle, came up there and started talking. And as he talked, I reverted to being a little boy. And I was a voyeur in his story. I could almost smell the fragrances that were in the story. And it was amazing. And I thought to myself, I can do this. So I retired that day. And I retired from the railroad and said, I'm going to be a storyteller. And from that point on, it was just an evolution that happens and continues to happen. I'm greatly impressed by, like Maureen, I'm sitting here just absolutely mesmerized by the story. She tells historical stories that I love. And there are other people, when they start the story, it's like, thank you for letting me come into your mind. And you just enjoy.
Yeah, I think that's the great thing about storytelling is its profound intimacy. And that's, you know, the first year we did the Storytelling Festival, we had a presidium stage and turned on the lights so that the storyteller couldn't see the dark, just like a theater production. Well, we found out right away they want to be in touch with the audience. And so we took them off the stage and down right in front of the seating so they could do that. And in the years we've done the Storytelling Festival, we try to mix the different cultures. We had this marvelous young man from Nova Scotia, and he told all these stories of the sea and the ghost stories of Nova Scotia and places like that. Then Tim Tingle, who really was very pivotal for you, I saw him up at one of the elementary schools just mesmerizing the kids, you know. And he was beating on the drum and doing all the Indian rituals, and the kids were – that's the real fun. To watch children, when we take the storytellers to the schools, understand these marvelous chemistry that happens when the storyteller begins working. And I took one of our storytellers, who was from Appalachia, to the high school. All these boys and girls file in, you know, expecting, then their sweatsuits, and it's just another break in the day and an assembly, you know, very surly teenagers. And then in 10 minutes, he had him rolling in the aisle. Mm-hmm. And I knew the mother of one of these boys, and he texted his mother, "This is the greatest thing I've ever seen."
Well, scientists tell us now that there is different brain activity during a story, and many neurons and synapses are fired off, producing positive endorphins. And children who have stories told to them in the oral fashion before they begin to read are better readers. And it gives them a greater sense of pattern recognition, emotion, all of those types of things. And so it's very beneficial and very important to tell young people stories and to continue to tell them because, indeed, they do give us a path through life with morals and lessons. They tell us how to and how not to live in certain societies.
Oh, yes. And what I just spoke of is the metamorphosis happening with these teenagers. This is also a phenomenon with husbands who get dragged to the festival by their wives.
Yes, indeed.
And they go in there very – so you could just see the body language. In the end, they're applauding uproariously. So it's there's something magic about storytelling and something magical about Christmas. So what a marvelous merger at this time of the year to do storytelling in the Christmas vein. And I think, Maureen, you have a short story too, don't you? A little.
Oh, I do. I do want to tell you before I tell you this, though, that if anybody is interested in learning more about storytelling, they can come to Des Moines to the Playhouse. We have a storytelling guild there that meets every fourth Sunday of the month at 4 o'clock in the Loud Room.
That's the Des Moines Playhouse on 42nd Street,
yes.
Very near the exit.
And it's called the Two River Story Spinners. And if you need more information on that, you can call the Playhouse or me or Dan or the station here. And we have conferences and festivals going on all over.
I'm sure we're going to include some of that on our website here at KHOI.
Yes. So leave us the information.
Yeah. Once upon a dark and snowy night, known as Christmas Eve, an old wizard with waning powers walked into a tiny village. Not wanting to produce food from his limited magic, he began knocking on doors, begging, starting at the top of the hill with the biggest house that had the most lights. When he knocked, the lady of the home came and looked at him and then gave him no chance to speak. Instead, she merely slammed the door on his face and said, "Get away from here, you beggar!" On down the hill he went to every door, asking for food and being denied, until he came to the bottom of the hill, the smallest and the most dilapidated house. He knocked on the door. Shuffle. Shuffle. Click. Bang. The door opened, and there stood a young girl. She had no shoes on her feet and a small shawl wrapped around her shoulders. Only one candle and no fire was lit in her home. "What can I do for you?" she said. "Why don't you come in? You look so cold." "Well, I am, and I'm looking for food, but I don't feel you have any to share." "Oh, I was just starting my soup. Come, sit at the table," she said, and split the little she had with him. That night she had him sleep on the floor and put him closest to the one lump of coal that she had in the fireplace. The next morning when he left, he said, "You have been so kind to me, my sweet thing, that when I close the door, the first thing you do will come back to you in threes full of bounty." She did not understand this and shut the door and went back to her spinning wheel as she would every morning. But today she noticed that as she spun, indeed, piles and piles and piles of wool were gathering up on the floor. Why, more than she felt she had spinning material for. She took it into town and sold it the next day and got three times the money she usually did. All year long this happened, to the point where she became quite well-to-do. The next year on Christmas Eve, the same wizard came to the same town. He began knocking on doors and was invited in by many, for indeed it had been rumored that he had magical powers and would give them and their magic to people who helped him. He did not go in anywhere, though. Instead, he waited until he got to the top of the hill and knocked on the door of the richest lady. She opened the door and grabbed him. "Oh, come in," she said. She sat him down at a table and fed him in a luxurious fashion. She gave him water for a bath and the most comfortable bed. And then the next morning, she got out a bag of gold and set it on the table, for she planned to go touch it as soon as he told her that he would give her bounty times three, and then she knew she would be even richer. Indeed, she followed him to the door and told him goodbye, and he said, "Oh, yes, and for your kindness, when I close the door, the first thing you do will come back to you in bounty times three." "Shh!" The door was closed. The woman turned and achoo! Sneezed all day, all night, and indeed into the new year, never ever reaching the gold.
That's very good.
That's a classic story. A classic version of this. Yes.
Well, be careful what you wish for.
Yes. And be careful being nice to people just because you think they're going to do something nice for you.
Yes, indeed.
Dan, do you have another story?
Well, it's I'll tell you some things from when I was young. My dad worked for the railroad. And every Christmas, we would wait for him to come home. And sometimes we would wait past midnight. But he would come in, and then we'd celebrate and would have some presents and things like that and sing some songs. And it was always wonderful when that would happen. Now, as a father myself, and I've been married for about 35 years, and I too worked for the railroad. And I recall it was the one holiday that I was bound to be home. Even if I had to be sick 2 days ahead so that I could be home. But when I came home, it was always Christmas. And I lived for that because Christmas to me is a sacred part of the year, but it's also a time for family. So my family has always tried to be together on Christmas. And even through storms and everything else, we try to make Christmas our special holiday.
I hope indeed that happens again this year, Dan.
Indeed. Yes.
Well, you have really inspired me. And the story, though, that I want to tell is really a story that exists almost entirely as stories, stories that veterans from World War I brought back with them. And since that time, John McCutcheon has made a song out of it and written a book, but the stories discovered are the best. I first heard the story
from a German friend of mine, now in her 90s, whose father was a young German soldier during World War I.
And he told about Christmas Eve in the trenches. And there was a truce, so there was no firing. And as they sat there with whatever little things they had, someone started to sing Silent Night. Probably the German soldiers sang Stille Nacht. They sang together. Pretty soon, when the song was over, they got out of the trenches and they came across and they showed each other pictures of home, and sometimes they may have shared some little thing they had. And then somebody suggested a soccer game, and they played soccer. And then when it was over, they went back and the truce was over in the morning. But Christmas in the Trenches is a story that was told by him. And John McCutcheon discovered he was meeting veterans who had had this experience, but it's never been written down. And so people wondered if it really happened.
Well, I was lying with my messmates on the cold and rocky ground when across the lines of battle came a most peculiar sound. Says I, now listen up, me boys, each soldier strained to hear, as one young German voice sang out so clear. He's singing bloody well, you know, my partner says to me. Soon one by one each German voice joined in harmony. The cannons rested silent, the gas clouds rolled no more, as Christmas brought us respite from the war. Well, as soon as they were finished and reverent pause was spent, God rest ye merry gentlemen struck up some lads from Kent. Next they sang was Stille Nacht, 'tis Silent Night, says I, and in two tongues one song filled up that sky. There's someone coming towards us, the frontline sentry cried. All sights were fixed on one lone figure trudging from their side. His truce flag like a Christmas star shone on that plain so bright, as he bravely strode unarmed into the night. Soon one by one on either side walked into no man's land. With neither gun nor bayonet we met there hand to hand. We shared some secret brandy and we wished each other well, And in a flare-lit soccer game, we gave him hell. We traded chocolates, cigarettes, and photographs from home. These sons and fathers far away from families of their own. Young Sanders played his squeeze box. They had a violin, this curious and unlikely band of men. Soon daylight stole upon us, and France was France once more. With sad farewells we each began to settle back to war. But the question haunted every heart that beat that wondrous night. Whose family have I fixed within my sights? 'Twas Christmas in the trenches where the frost so bitter hung. The frozen fields of France were warmed as songs of peace were sung. The walls they'd kept between us to exact the work of war had been crumbled and were gone forevermore.
So when I thought about that story, I thought, how would you end the story? And the way that seemed most appropriate to me, that's very local, is here in our listening area in Slater. There is the Bethlehem Lutheran Church in Palestine Township. And it seems to me, if there's one place that should be iconic of a Christmas Eve service, it would be the Bethlehem Lutheran Church. So I called them and asked them how they celebrated. And they said, well, we read some Bible scripture and we sing some Christmas carols. But at the end, we turn off the lights and we pass the candles around, and we each lights a candle for the next, and we sing Silent Night. So I'd like to end tonight with this experience. So if you've ever been to a Christmas Eve service, or even if you haven't, you've been with your family on Christmas Eve, shut your eyes and imagine you're in your favorite place to be on Christmas Eve, and that the candles are lit, and that you are singing Silent Night.
That is part of my culture. I'm a Lutheran, so we do Silent Night as the end of our service after singing carols and usually the Christmas pageant. I remember wearing a bathrobe and playing Joseph, and we all did that after 2 hours of rehearsal, and the kings marched in. We three kings of Orient are. And you know, I was bothered by that. You know, the rehearsal on Saturday and wearing a bathrobe. But then at Luther College, I was working with the radio station, and someone had to stay up in snowy cold decora all alone on the campus to do the radio station daily schedule. And it was then that I got homesick. I would have given my left arm to be in a bathrobe at the Christmas pageant. And before we leave today, Merry Christmas, Happy New Year, Happy Hanukkah, Happy whatever holiday it is you're celebrating, because it seems like so many religions celebrate the winter solstice. And maybe Druids are hearing this and saying, yeah, we like winter solstice.
This has been Local Talk on KHOI.
Our guests for today have been Maureen Corton and Dan Bagley, with hosts Paul Wearson and Susan Franson. The music you heard was Stille Nacht by the Vienna Boys Choir from the CD Merry Christmas Carols from North America and Europe, and Christmas in the Trenches by John McCutcheon from the CD Christmas in the Trenches. Our theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD The Ballad of Kate Shelley.
And we thank those of you who have become members in this year. If you have not joined KHOI as a member yet, please consider doing so before the end of the year.
Thank you for listening, and see you again on the radio.